Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is Eric Foner, DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University, and one of America's most distinguished historians. Few have written as extensively about mid-19th century America as Eric Foner, and perhaps none has shaped how the professoriate has come to understand this period. Foner's most recent work is The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery, which won the Pulitzer Prize, the Bancroft Prize, and the Lincoln Prize. 150 years ago, in the midst of the Civil War, Lincoln was ambling toward the Emancipation Proclamation. Following from his visit to Memphis last February, in commemoration of that event, Foner took time out of his holiday in the Berkshires to speak with us about Lincoln, race, and slavery. Eric, thanks for being with us on Counterpoint.
I'm very happy to be here.
Eric, before diving into your work on Lincoln, I want to talk a little bit about how you came to study the issues of race, slavery, the Civil War, and Reconstruction. In your book, Who Owns History, you have a chapter that wonderfully traces your story. Can you give us a quick overview of how you came to study these issues, talking a little bit about the influence of your father and uncle, the influence of British historians on your work, and how your groundbreaking book on Reconstruction came to transform how historians understand the post-Civil War period?
Historians are not all that introspective a group. We don't tend to write autobiographies or things like that, so often we're not really very adept at analyzing the influences on ourselves. But certainly, I grew up in a family which was, you know, quite left-wing in the 1940s, 50s, and my father and uncle, my father Jack Foner and my uncle Philip Foner, the latter a very, very prolific historian, were both historians. Both of them were blacklisted during the McCarthy period because of their political views and couldn't teach for many years. But in my family, history was often spoken about, and I grew up sort of hearing about a different kind of history than you picked up in public schools in the 1950s. It was a history in which issues relating to blacks, slavery, emancipation, civil rights were central to American history. At that time, most historians tended to ignore those things. And dissenters, Eugene Debs, Frederick Douglass, Tom Paine, were as important as, you know, the iconic figures, whether Lincoln or Jefferson, etc. So I kind of imbibed this alternative view of history, which later became quite common, actually, among people reading and writing history. But then in the 1960s, when I was in college, events in the world affected me and the whole generation, particularly the Civil Rights Revolution. And that really placed on the agenda for anyone who thought about American life the problem of race, the history of race, the origins of this national crisis. And many of us who were studying history at that time really became very interested in slavery, the anti-slavery movement, and the consequences of emancipation and why the end of slavery didn't produce genuine freedom for black Americans. I had a wonderful teacher at Columbia College, James Shenton, not known as a scholar, a writer, but a wonderful, inspiring teacher who it was in his classes that I first encountered the study of the Civil War era. And as you say, then later, once I was an assistant professor, I found myself influenced by the generation of British social historians, Eric Hobsbawm, E.P. Thompson, George Roudet, who really were writing what is now called history from the bottom up, really emphasizing the role of ordinary people in helping to shape history. And all of those kinds of influences came together in the book you referred to, Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, which was published about 25 years ago now, I think, in which I try to rewrite the history of that period. You know, of course, many, many historians have been analyzing it, but there was still a sort of general assumption out there that Reconstruction was a period purely of corruption, misgovernment, and it had been a terrible mistake to give black men the right to vote after the Civil War. They weren't prepared for it, etc. And I wanted to really show the role of African Americans in helping to shape the agenda at that time, helping to rewrite the Constitution and put the issue of equality and citizenship into our national laws and Constitution. And the effort, which did not succeed, but was, I think, a noble one to try to create an interracial democracy in the South from the ashes of slavery. Reconstruction failed, of course. And I think its failure really put the whole issue off for another 100 years. The Civil Rights Revolution was sometimes called the Second Reconstruction, the second time, 100 years later, that the country really tried to bring African Americans into the mainstream of American democracy. So, I don't know, that's a kind of brief attempt to answer your question, which is complicated. But, you know, that's how I sort of think about it, looking back on my own career.
It is complicated, but I mean, in these two phrases where you talk about Reconstruction as America's second unfinished revolution and the Civil Rights Movement as the second Reconstruction, we get a bit of a sense. Now, to turn to the book on Lincoln, giving a bird's eye view of the book, you write that it traces the evolution of Lincoln's ideas and policies about slavery from his early life through his career in the Illinois legislature in the 1830s, his term in Congress in the 1840s, his emergence as a leader of the new Republican Party in the 1850s, and his presidency during the Civil War. You note at the end of that that it's intended to be both less and more than another biography. Explain exactly what you mean by this last line. How is the book both less and more than another biography?
Well, it's easy to explain how it's less than a biography. There are innumerable biographies of Lincoln out there, as you know, ranging from 60 or 70 pages biographies to multi-volume ones. And there are many aspects of Lincoln's life that I'm not writing about. I'm not writing about his marriage. I'm not writing about many of the military aspects of the Civil War. So I'm not just retracing the entire life the way a biographer would, although it is chronological and it does follow Lincoln's life. As you said, the issue is Lincoln and slavery. That's what I'm interested in. There are many other issues in Lincoln's life, which I'm not writing about. But it's more than a biography because I'm really trying to place Lincoln in context and in relation to the whole spectrum of thinking about slavery in the time that he lived, ranging from radical abolitionists on one end. Lincoln was not an abolitionist, though he knew abolitionists and was influenced by them. People who demanded the immediate abolition of slavery, that was not Lincoln's point of view most of the time. And then on the other side, the much more conservative people who either, I'm talking about the North, who really didn't want to do anything about slavery, or if they did think about getting rid of slavery, thought in very long term and, you know, ways that wouldn't disrupt anything for a long, long time. And I'm trying to trace out how Lincoln's views changed and why they changed and what the influences on him were. So I'm sketching out his society as well as Lincoln himself, and that's why it's more than just a conventional biography.
I want to drill a little bit deeper with you into this range of various opinions on the question of slavery and race at the time that Lincoln was working out his own position. Lincoln's early views on slavery were shaped a lot by his two great political heroes, Henry Clay and Thomas Jefferson. They were both anti-slavery slave owners who were strong advocates of what was called colonization. Can you explain what the scheme of colonization was all about when it came to the question of slavery?
Well, you know, we don't hear much about colonization nowadays in reading about the Civil War era, but it was a very widespread belief. As you said, both Jefferson and Clay believed in it strongly. It basically, what the colonizationists said, and there are varieties within that group, was that, yes, slavery is wrong. Slavery should be gotten rid of, no question about it. But black and white cannot live as equals in American society, and therefore, when slavery ends, black people should, and here depends whether you want to say be encouraged or forced or deported, but should leave the country. The American Colonization Society thought they should be sent to Africa, and they even set up Liberia, you know, this nation where blacks would be sent. Others thought, well, that's kind of far. What about Central America, Haiti? But the underlying principle was that the races had to be separated. Now, why did they have to be separated? Jefferson wrote about this in Notes on the State of Virginia. He said, you know, they can't live together because if they do, what he called amalgamation would follow. You know what I'm talking about. Jefferson practiced amalgamation, apparently, with one of his slaves, but he thought it was a horrible fate. It would destroy the white race, and therefore you had to separate black and white. Henry Clay had a different reason. He said black people are criminal, dangerous. If let free, they'll run amok and destroy the society. It's immoral to hold them as slaves, but they can't live as free people in American society. And there were others who said, no, the reason that, and this is actually what Lincoln mostly said, the reason black people should be sent abroad is that they can only enjoy equality somewhere else. Racism is so deep in American life that when you free the slaves, they will never be accorded equal rights. Now, Lincoln came from Kentucky. I mean, he was born in Kentucky and lived his adult life in Illinois. Illinois is one of the most racist states in the nation at that time. It had severe laws discriminating against the free black population there. And Lincoln kind of imbibed in Illinois the notion that white America would never really accord equality to black people. So for various reasons, and one of the things that surprised me in working on this book was how long and how, you know, sincerely Lincoln believed in this idea of colonization. One thing I picked up that no one really knew, I mean, it's hard to come up with anything new about Lincoln, what was that in 1858, when he ran for the Senate against Stephen A. Douglas, he was an official of the Illinois Colonization Society. So this was not just something he mentioned in a speech now and then. This was something he was committed to. He was part of an organization committed to colonization. And colonization had this appeal that you could get rid of slavery and yet also get rid of the race problem at the same time. You didn't have to answer the question, what will happen to these black people in America once free? They're not going to be here, so we don't have to worry about that.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about some of the other positions on the spectrum. You've made clear that Lincoln was, from very early on, strongly anti-slavery, but that he wasn't an abolitionist. He also wasn't a radical Republican. He never claimed to be one. So what exactly defined the abolitionist position, which you actually argue emerged as a response to colonization?
The abolitionist position emerges among both black and white Northerners in the late 1820s, early 1830s, largely to combat this colonization idea. It basically says, look, we agree we have to get rid of slavery. In fact, it should be done immediately. But black people are Americans. They have as much right to be here as anyone else. And they should be accorded equal rights as members of the American nation. That is, emancipation should be followed by the incorporation of the former slaves into the mainstream of American life. That was a very radical position at that time. It was definitely a minority position. But nonetheless, the abolitionists put forward this alternative vision of America, a nation in which the rights of people are not defined by race. In a sense, the abolitionists invented the America we know today. An America of equality, of freedom, without regard to race. Obviously, there are racial inequalities still existing in the society, but in the law, in the Constitution, we have adopted the abolitionist position, which was completely off the mainstream in the 1830s and 40s. Abolitionists were a small minority. The majority of Northerners never became abolitionists. If you were a rising politician like Lincoln, especially in Illinois, you were not going to be an abolitionist. But I'm not saying that Lincoln was a secret abolitionist and just couldn't say it because he wanted to get elected. You know, Lincoln, as I said, believed in a much more long-term process, gradual emancipation, colonization, and for much of his life, he could not accept the notion of black people being equal members of American society. At the very end of his life, he is moving in that direction. His views on race change, I think, dramatically during the Civil War. But before the Civil War, he's certainly not an abolitionist, although he knows abolitionists, he's friendly with abolitionists, and he understands that abolitionists are part of this broad anti-slavery movement.
Was abolitionism the same thing as radical republicanism, or was there a difference?
Not exactly. I would say radical republicans are people who represent the abolitionist position in politics. Many abolitionists didn't even believe you should vote, you know, that the Constitution was pro-slavery, and therefore to vote was to accept the protections of slavery under the Constitution. Radical republicans wanted to get rid of slavery, but being in Congress, you know, in politics, they had to accept the compromises of the Constitution. There was nothing Congress could do to get rid of slavery. Slavery is a state institution. It's a creature of state law. It's protected by the Constitution. The Fugitive Slave Clause says that slaves who escape have to be sent back from the North. So radical Republicans may want to get rid of slavery as much as abolitionists, but they operate within a political world where the options for doing so are quite narrow.
We could say that abolitionists questioned in much more radical kinds of ways the racism of American law and of the Constitution at the time. And when you talked earlier about this ideal of equality within America today that we've inherited that's in the law and the Constitution, you're, of course, referring to the ways in which that was transformed over the course of the Civil War itself.
Well, the Civil War is sometimes called the Second American Revolution, you know, because it revolutionized the country. It didn't just preserve the Union. It did, or put it this way, it did not go back to the old pre-war Union. Eventually, obviously, it led to the destruction of slavery, but it also put on the agenda this question of black citizenship and equality. And I think one of the key things that led in that direction was the enrollment of black soldiers in the Union Army. At the beginning of the war, Lincoln, you know, the Union Army did not allow blacks to enlist. The army was all white. But as the war went on and the demand for manpower grew greater and greater, In the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln for the first time publicly invites African-American men into the U.S. armies, and by the end of the war, something like 200,000 have served in the Army and Navy, and by doing so, they have staked a claim to citizenship. In other words, you can't just say to people, fight for the nation, and then we're going to ship you out somewhere else when the war is over. It put on the agenda this question of civil rights, of legal equality, and Lincoln himself, at the very end of his life, in what we call his last speech, April 1865, for the first time publicly says, I think the soldiers should have the right to vote after the war. They have earned the right to vote. Now, you might say that's not all blacks, but, you know, only five northern states allowed any blacks to vote at that time. Illinois didn't allow any blacks to vote. And so Lincoln is sort of getting ahead of the curve by the end of his life in saying that the soldiers should be part of the body politic because of their service to the nation.
I want to get into these issues in a little bit more detail. If you've just tuned in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking with Eric Foner, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery. Eric, to get into this in a little bit more detail, let's talk a little bit about how Lincoln's views on race itself changed. You say he never wavered in his opposition to slavery, but he had internalized deep prejudices about blacks. Lincoln's views on race never really came to light until the 1960s, and I'm wondering how you would respond today to the article in Ebony from that era titled, Was Abe Lincoln a White Supremacist? So was
Jerome Bennett, a very influential article. Bennett, a black historian and writer, and, you know, remember, he's writing that in Ebony, right? Ebony is a magazine directed to black readers. I mean, anybody can read it, but it's basically a black magazine. And he's telling blacks themselves to stop idolizing Lincoln, you know, to say, don't wait around for a white emancipator. If you want to free yourself, as in the 1960s people are demanding, you got to do it yourself, you know. So in a sense, it's not, he didn't invent material, but he's using the argument to talk about his own time, that, you know, black people should not just wait for someone to free them, so to speak. Now, you know, what I said in the book is, one of the things, again, that surprised me is how little Lincoln actually said about race. Race was not something that Lincoln talked about a lot. Jefferson mulls over these questions, are black people inferior, not mentally, etc. Lincoln doesn't talk about that. When Lincoln talks about race, it's really in 1858 in the Senate campaign when he's accused over and over by Stephen A. Douglas of believing in, quote, Negro equality, something that no politician could affirm at that time. And first Lincoln says, you know, this is ridiculous. I'm talking about slavery. Negro equality has nothing to do with it. But eventually his supporters say, Lincoln, you got to respond. This is a very, you know, this charge is injuring your campaign. So Lincoln says, and this is what Bennett quotes and many people quote, I do not believe in Negro equality. I do not believe in blacks voting. I do not believe in blacks holding office. And he also says, and I think the best solution is to separate the races, and blacks should leave the country voluntarily. He doesn't say they should be shipped out by force, but still they should leave the country, be colonized somewhere else. So certainly that's a racist view, and Lincoln accepts the idea of America as a white country, and blacks are kind of an alien group within the society. Although he never, you know, abuses blacks politically. Stephen A. Douglas, his opponent, is always going on about how they're inferior and they're dangerous and they're horrible and this is just a white country. Lincoln never does anything like that. And in fact, he never even says black people are unequal. The most he'll say is, well, they're not equal in color. What the hell does that mean? They're not my equal in color. You know, he doesn't say they're not my equal intellectually, culturally, whatever. In other words, he doesn't have this visceral racism, although he certainly shares the prejudices of his time. But in the Civil War, his views begin to change, and especially with emancipation, especially with the service of black soldiers, especially, I think, meeting educated, articulate black political leaders. You know, he didn't meet any such people in Illinois, but now in the White House, he meets with Frederick Douglass, he meets with Sojourner Truth, he meets with a whole number of black visitors, black delegations. He's the first president who actually ever does that. No president before Lincoln had actually allowed black people into the White House to talk to the president. I mean, they were slaves working in the White House, but I'm talking about as citizens. And I think his views begin to mellow as he comes in contact with these articulate, politically active black people who he had, you know, he had never had any contact with people like that before. He comes to really respect, for example, Frederick Douglass. He listens to Douglass. He asks Douglass for advice on various things. And I think by the end of his life, he is accepting the notion of African Americans as an intrinsic part of American life. I'm not saying he became Martin Luther King Jr., you know, but he certainly has traveled a long, long way from the prejudices of the pre-war era.
I was surprised, however, that while it's clear that his views on race are changing, well into 1862, when emancipation was now being entertained in a whole number of circles, Lincoln was continuing to advocate gradual emancipation and compensation to slave owners, coupled with colonization. He once remarked of the process that led to emancipation, "I claim not to have controlled events, but confess plainly that events have controlled me." So is it wrong to claim that the Emancipation Proclamation was issued by Lincoln on principled grounds? Was Lincoln really just a pragmatist when he issued the Emancipation Proclamation?
That's a very legitimate question. I think like any major act of government, the Emancipation Proclamation was issued for many reasons at the same time.
Give us some of those reasons.
Was it issued on principle grounds? Well, yes. A man who was not anti-slavery would not have issued it. But that was not the main reason it was issued. It was issued, as Lincoln said explicitly in it, on military grounds. It was issued in order to help the nation win the war. Lincoln had become convinced that slavery must become a target of the war. In other words, the North could not win purely as a war of army against army. It had to become a war of society against society. You had to target the infrastructure of Southern life, which was slavery. And you also had to get those black men into the army by this point. And you're not going to do that unless you offer them freedom. So Lincoln really feels that this is... And military necessity is the only constitutional ground for Lincoln to issue it. It's issued under his power as commander-in-chief of the Union Army. There's nothing in the Constitution that authorizes the president to just declare slaves free just because he's principally, you know, on principle opposed to slavery. But he uses the military justification. But what's interesting, I think, is once he issues it, he will never go back on it. In other words, there's where principle comes in. Even in 1864, when many people think he's going to lose the presidential election, and Republicans are saying, look, rescind the proclamation. People here think the proclamation is prolonging the war. The South will never agree to peace as long as the proclamation is out there. And Lincoln says, you know, I can't do that. I would be damned in time and eternity if I promised people freedom and then withdrew the promise. So, in other words, to maintain the proclamation is a measure of principle.
Now, you say you state the obvious, which is that the Emancipation Proclamation never freed all slaves. But you've also said that it's one of the most misunderstood aspects of American history. Can you clarify what actually happened with the Emancipation Proclamation? Who was freed? Who wasn't freed?
That with one stroke of his pen, Lincoln freed all the slaves. That is not what happened. First of all, obviously, if you just read it, it exempts many slaves. It doesn't apply to the border states, the four slave states, Missouri, Kentucky, Delaware, and Maryland that are in the Union. There's about 500,000 slaves there. It doesn't apply to them. They're not part of the war of the Confederacy. And Lincoln also exempts, for complicated reasons, certain parts of the Confederacy, southern Louisiana, the whole state of Tennessee. So all told, of the 4 million slaves, about 750,000 are not even touched by the Emancipation Proclamation. So, you know, he certainly didn't free all the slaves. On the other hand, there are people who say, well, actually, on the day it was issued, it didn't free any slaves because it only applied to Confederate territory where it couldn't be enforced. That, I think, is a misunderstanding also. First of all, factually, it's not true because there were areas under Union control it did apply to, such as the Sea Islands of South Carolina. But more important, the proclamation is a turning point in the nation's relationship to slavery. Basically, it says if the North wins the war, slavery will be destroyed. If the South won the war, which was totally possible, slavery would have survived for a long time, no question about it. But it means that the war will not end without, in terms of Union victory, without destroying slavery. So it transforms the nature of the Civil War. It's not important what happens on that day, January 1st, 1863. It's the making the abolition of slavery now a explicit aim of the Union war effort.
Now, when Lincoln was murdered by John Wilkes Booth on April 14th, 1865, setting up the terms of Reconstruction was still very much in flux. At the end of the book, you discuss how things would have been different if Lincoln had lived rather than leaving Reconstruction to Andrew Johnson, who you claim was one of the worst presidents in American history. What made Johnson such a bad president and Lincoln such a great president?
Well, you know, that's a question that all historians ask about almost any time period. Is greatness the man, the times in which he's living, some combination of the two, you know? Lincoln is great because he faced an enormous challenge and rose to the challenge. He rose to the occasion. But Andrew Johnson also faced an enormous challenge, the challenge of Reconstruction, but he sank beneath the waves. He could not rise to the occasion. Lincoln was open-minded. Lincoln was intellectually curious. Lincoln was interested in people's criticisms of what he was doing. He was willing to change his mind if he felt he was on the wrong track. Johnson was stubborn, did not listen to anybody, would not take criticism, and deeply, deeply racist, far more racist than Lincoln had ever been. And, you know, Lincoln, by the end of his life, had accepted the notion of blacks becoming part, in some undefined way, of American life. Johnson felt they should just go back to work on the plantations and not bother white people, and the process of Reconstruction was for whites only. And then when it became clear that his plan was just putting the old Confederates back into power to oppress the former slaves, he refused to budge. And he eventually alienated the entire Congress and, as you know, was impeached and almost removed from office. It's inconceivable to imagine Lincoln becoming so alienated from Congress, so alienated from Northern public opinion, that he would actually be impeached and almost thrown out of office. He was far too attuned to public sentiment and to the Republican Party. You know, counterfactual history is not history, obviously. And I only put those few pages at the end, what might have happened if Lincoln had lived, because whenever I lecture about Lincoln anywhere, people always ask me that. And it's, as I say, it's not history, but I would say with some confidence that the crisis of Reconstruction would not have developed the way it had, the way it did, if Lincoln had lived. Lincoln would have, no doubt, come to some agreement with Congress about Reconstruction, just as he came to agreements with Congress about everything during the Civil War. He would never have gotten into this impasse the way Johnson did, based on Johnson's own stupidity and stubbornness. So what the end result would have been, I don't know. Maybe Reconstruction was doomed from the outset. Maybe American society was too racist to really encompass blacks as equal members of the society. Would Lincoln have been able to solve the problem? I don't know. But there probably would have been a better chance if Lincoln had lived than under President Andrew Johnson.
But I do think it's so interesting that what you see as part of the greatness of Lincoln's character is his willingness to change and his open-mindedness, I suppose, as opposed to Johnson's closed-mindedness, especially with respect to the issue of race. Eric, I want to close the interview by talking a little bit about how you opened the Fury trial. There you open by talking about Lincoln as an icon, embodying the society's core values and myths, and also stating that the issues of Lincoln's era remain as urgent today as when he lived. Tell me a little bit about how you think Lincoln has become a lens through which we Americans examine ourselves, as you put it, and what were the key issues in his lifetime that are still ours?
Right. Well, of course, Lincoln is you know, in a way, he seems to represent, as I said, these core values, whether it's the frontier, you know, the self-made man, the liberator of the slaves, the politician who acts for moral purposes, if that's what he did. He does seem to have a special place, you know, among American presidents. So whenever people do these polls of historians or popular polls to rank the presidents, which is kind of absurd, Lincoln always ends up way near the top, whether he's first or second, Franklin Roosevelt, et cetera, might be up there. So, you know, people really do admire Lincoln, and people try to. David Donald once wrote an interesting essay, the historian, Getting Right with Lincoln, in which he showed how every political tendency, left, right, and center, communists, conservatives, segregationists, civil rights advocates, tries to associate Lincoln with their point of view. If you can get Lincoln on your side, so to speak, you gain a position of formidable power in political debates. The reason Lincoln is still relevant and the Civil War and Reconstruction is still relevant is that, as I say, these core issues are still around. The question of who is a citizen and what rights citizens ought to have. That's as current as today's newspapers. Issues relating to race. Of course, we have changed enormously since then. I don't think Lincoln could have imagined the United States electing a black man as president. Nonetheless, racial inequality still is part of our society. There's no question about that. The question of the relations of the states to the federal government, you know, where does power lie? I mean, we have a Tea Party, conservatives today, who want to go, you know, back to a more state-oriented, local-oriented political structure with the federal government far more limited than it is right now. So those issues of federalism, of state-national relations, which are at the core of the Civil War also, are still with us today. And even presidential power, you know, so many current issues were around in the Civil War. Presidential power, civil liberties in wartime. Even terrorism. You know, we had a whole experience of homegrown terrorism during Reconstruction, the Ku Klux Klan and groups like that. It's a sad reflection, I think, to say, but it's true that the Klan and kindred groups murdered more Americans during Reconstruction than Osama bin Laden managed to do during his lifetime. You know, all those questions are still on our agenda today, which is why Lincoln and the Civil War remain points of fascination, I think.
Thank you so much for sharing your insights on Lincoln and slavery with us and why they shed light on the issues that we face today.
Delighted to talk to you.
Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals and how their work illuminates the issues we face regionally and globally. Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO FM. To listen to the show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by clicking on the links in the right column on the Counterpoint page at WKNO or by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.